Welcome to the Wonder Women Tech Show, where we highlight, celebrate, and amplify global leaders who are creating impact. We humanize our role models and curate a culture of vulnerability and belonging. This is a show designed to innovate, empower, and ignite. I'm your host, Lisa Mae Brunson. Innovators, it's Lisa Mae Brunson with the Wonder Women Tech Show. And today's guest is someone we've had the honor to have on our stage as a speaker for Wonder Women Tech, and she is an award-winning trans activist and top voice in highlighting the challenges and policies affecting trans humans and trans rights. Celia Daniels is a healthcare management consultant who educates, empowers, and advocates for transgender and gender diverse individuals in the corporate world, public sector, and academic and medical institutions through her bathroom to boardroom advocacy. As an Asian Indian trans woman, born and raised in a conservative family in southern India, she writes and speaks passionately about the struggles and challenges she faced in her family, work, and community in the United States and India. She has built an ecosystem of alliances with local businesses, police departments, therapists, doctors, churches, and civil rights organizations in the U.S. and India to educate them about bullying, transgender violence, discrimination, healthcare policies, and economic empowerment. Celia is recognized as one of the top 20 LGBTQ+ leaders in biopharma and the top 10 LGBTQ+ voices on LinkedIn in the U.S. and Canada. She is also a top 100 LGBTQ+ women in DEI worldwide, along with Laverne Cox, Wanda Sykes, Lily Tomlin, and others. She is definitely in good company. She is the founder and CEO of Rebecon Consulting, serves on the executive board of Trans Can Work, Inc., and is the VP of PFLAG and Stonewall Democrats of Ventura County, California. Welcome to the show, Celia.
Thank you so much, Lisa, for having me. That must be a mouthful.
I am used to citing the accomplishments of all of our amazing guests. So I love celebrating the work and impact that you do.
Thank you.
And I'm excited to sit down with you today and dive deeper into your powerful work advocating for and on behalf of transhumans. And so I want to listen and learn from you so I can discover how to be an even greater ally.
Thank you, Lisa. I appreciate it.
Before we dive deeper, I'd love to learn more about your childhood in India and your upbringing. So what was that experience like?
That's a great question, Lisa May. I have known you for a while, right? We've known each other for a while, but we never got a chance to sit down and talk about our professional and personal experience. One of the things that I wanted to share, especially in this podcast, is about my childhood, as you mentioned in that question. I'm a South Asian and I grew up in India. So I would say that somewhere around 4 years old, I knew I was different. I told my mom that I was different, and she saw that there were a lot of proofs in terms of the way that I was interacting, and she knew that my gender wasn't doing justice to my anatomy. And here I was, really confused. I used to cover my head with my mom's sari and pretending to be a girl, and I really wanted to be a girl. I remember probably at 8, 7, my mom telling me that you're a boy and you are not a girl, so you cannot wear your cousin's clothes anymore. I used to wear the clothes, and my mom thought it was cute because I was the second son for my parents, and they were expecting a girl, and here, lo and behold, I came out as a boy, but still I was a girl deep inside, and I didn't know what was going on. So when my mom told me that you cannot wear women's clothes, that's when the trauma started happening, where my birth gender wasn't aligning with my identity. I didn't know at the time it was called gender incongruence. And every time I would wake up in the morning and pretend to be a boy, it was the other way. What can I do today I was so aware of my identity, my birth identity as a boy, that I had to survive in this world, just navigating through the stereotypical patriarchal society that was in India, so that I would not be even having a trace of a girl. And I was scared of getting bullied at school. And there were a lot of elements that I was so afraid of. There were so many things about the trauma that I faced, and I didn't know how to handle it.
Celia, it's an important experience in recognizing who you are, accepting and claiming your identity, and taking the steps to own that. There are many humans out there who face challenges in accepting who they are, and many who face barriers to step into their full bodies and identities. For many, it can be incredibly traumatic. Can you walk us through your own experience of identity and belonging?
I also wanted to give a trigger warning to some of our audience who are listening today, because this conversation could be a little triggering for you. If you feel triggered, just remove yourself from this space for a few seconds and you can join back. Probably in my elementary school, my uncle molested me, and I carried that shame within me for a while, and I didn't know how to handle it. I didn't want to tell my mom. And then 2 years down the line, my cousin molested me again. And this is a time when I felt like children like me, I didn't know what was happening. Is this what happens to trans kids? So I carried the sense of already I was carrying a layer of gender incongruence, and then came the abuse. And when I went to the church back in India, while we were growing up, we went to the evangelical church. It was more of an Anglican denomination. And you're always taught that people like you are sinners, you're going to hell. And I thought that no matter what I do, growing up in a church, I am still going to go to hell, because I am slaughtered for hell. And that's what people told for folks like myself. I looked at the Hijra community around me in India, and they were not a great example to me, because there were a lot of them are sex workers. Though I identified with them, I didn't want to be them, because to me, that was a big no-no. I wanted to live my life where I wanted to be a successful person. I wanted to not carry that shame with me, but be more successful in my life. And that's what I was always hoping for. And there was a time in my life when my gender incongruence was getting to a point where I could not contain myself, and I had to go out as Celia. So I wore a long skirt and a top, and I covered my head with a scarf like a hijab, and I walked outside for the very first time. Probably I was like 11 or 12 years old in my ninth grade. I went outside. It was a dusk time. I was passing through a construction site. There was a security guard who saw me, and he called me and said, "Hey, what are you doing there?" In putting that into context, women do not walk through a construction site in the nighttime, especially because it's dangerous for them to be walking through a construction site. And they were, sometimes the construction workers are usually drunk and they are hanging out there. And so it's not safe for women to be walking there. And while I was walking through the construction site, this man called me, and he wanted me to come close to him. And he looked at me in the light, and he started laughing, because he said, "That's a boy. It's a boy dressed like a girl." And it was such an excitement for them. And all the men started yelling and hooting, and they were laughing and using the most derogatory language. And I was so scared as a child. For the very first time, I was trembling within my body, as to wondering, why would people just hate me because I look different? I'm just identifying as a girl. Why would you hate me for that? I didn't realize. And then with the noise they were making and the amount of excitement, they were making a lot of noise, and they were laughing, and the crowd started increasing from like 5 to 15, and almost 20 people were gathered around me, and some were saying, you know, "Beat him up" or something. So one of them was saying, you know, "Where is your dad? What's your dad doing? You know, you're such a shame. We're going to tie you up and take you to your dad, because you're such a disgrace to our society. You should not be living here." That trauma that day was so hard for me, and I almost thought I'm going to die. And I said to myself, even if I die here, even if you kill me, I'm not going to tell you where my parents are, because I don't want them to carry the shame that I'm carrying here today. And I just stood there, and they were trying to, you know, show like they were going to beat me up and all that. And I stood there and I said, "You know what? Do whatever you want. I'm not going to tell you my dad's name." They were yelling for a while, and suddenly, by some thought, I just started speaking in another language, Hindi. I live in southern part of India. We speak Tamil. but I spoke a language from another part of the country. They didn't understand what I was talking, and I was showing them different directions, and I was asking them, where is the direction to the market in Hindi? And they didn't know. They were just pointing me to some place. And I said, thank you. And I started running, and they were surprised, and they started chasing me. Came back home, long story short, it was such a traumatic experience for me. I didn't know if I can really come out. And here I was just learning to survive. And I was caught between, I was really scared of what's going to happen to me. What's my future? I didn't know about it. And I started thinking about suicide. Again, a trigger warning for some of you. I contemplated suicide twice, and I was at the point of losing breath from my body. And that's when I felt that I was afraid to die. And also, I was afraid to live. And this was such a difficult situation for me, not knowing where and what to do. And that was one of the experiences that I had. And I said, how do I live in this planet? I'm afraid to live, and I'm also afraid to die. What do I do? Fast forward many years, I have actually written a song with that, those words. I have posted on YouTube. I will share it with you, Lisa May. But one of the, you know, I went into a point in my life where I got into a denial. My brain just said, this is just not happening to me. I cannot die. I want to survive. I want to do something good in my life. And I went into this mode of completely blocking everything in my mind. And I said, I'm not trans person. You know, I'm just making it up. But I would always feel like there's something different about me.
Well, Celia, I'm honored to hold space for you and to really listen and receive your share, your story, your experiences, your trauma, your identity, your legacy. And this is the kind of conversation that I need for my own growth, for my own sense of humanity and compassion for all humans. And for their lived experiences, because I can't continue to do the work that I do without learning more from my fellow humans that are charting their own pathways, having their own experiences and their own and navigating their own challenges and understanding what does that look like? Because I can't occupy the space that you do. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful for the opportunity to sit here with you. And, you know, as I was listening, I just kept hearing, hold space, hold space. So, you know, you talked about the sort of childhood trauma that you went through that led you to walk yourself back, to disengage from your own identity. I think what's more traumatic here for, as I was listening, is the picture of this young human who is bravely trying to navigate the world as who they know themselves to be, and then encounter a mob mentality, a literal mob of humans that are unable to hold space, unable to understand that there are different identities and different humans that don't fit the mold or, you know, checkbox type of situation. That they met you with hatred, such a young kid to have that kind of hatred and that kind of, you know, severity in their brutality is traumatic. And I'm sorry that you went through that. I think for me, the biggest lesson I guess I am taking from your share is that even when you're bold, sometimes you're going to have to find yourself be bold over and over and over again, because people may not receive you or understand, and that trauma can lead to people not pushing forward. And at the end of the day, you did make that decision, though, to live. You did make that decision to walk your childhood out, to walk your, you know, adolescence out, to walk your young adulthood out. You did that. What were some of the childhood hobbies or interests that kept you going? What did you eventually cling on to that would allow you to walk it out one day at a time?
Lisa May, that is a beautiful question. The reason I'm saying that is I'm glad you reminded me. Music was one of the things that really kept me going. Well, I was in my childhood days, my dad had a business where he used to take those record players, you know, those, and then convert it to cassettes. And we had that business back home. And I remember recording a lot of songs and listening to so many records and songs across the world. It kept me going. And I listened to a lot of songs and I started singing those songs. So I had this keyboard at home and I started playing them just by my hearing sense. I never was taught. And then my brother taught me a little bit of guitar and he said, these are the chords. And he would just say and walk away. And I would just note it down. And I didn't know even how to play the guitar, but I just took the guitar, started learning. And music, I started writing songs. It came to a point where all the traumas and all the difficult situations in my life, I put that in form of a song. Music kept me going and the beach kept me going. The two areas that I've nature and music was the most important thing. That sometimes, as you said, right, holding space was so important that I had to hold space for Celia. And I was struggling not giving space for Celia. So I used to take off from home when we lived in a coastal side. So the beach was probably like 2 kilometers away from home, very, very close. So I went to the beach and sat all the time. And I used to sometimes take my skirt and then put it all around me, spread it across in the sand and just sit and think, oh my God, one day, can you please change me as a woman? God, I used to always keep praying. And I said, God, please change me as a woman. I want to be a woman. I really love, want to be a woman. I don't know how to be a woman, but I just enjoy being this. The joy trigger was so high. When I was Celia, the joy was so high. But when I wasn't, it was like somewhere in zero or negative. Music kept me going. My therapy sessions were the beach. I used to sit and talk to the universe. I just talked to God and I said, God, change me. Why did you make me like this? And I used to always ask these questions. It kept me going. And also my faith. Important thing was, even though the Bible said something, I still believe that there is a person who created me and I want to know why this happened to me. We grew up in a Christian faith and I still am a person of faith because I've gone back to the Bible and started reading the Bible and I've read it cover to cover. The more you read, the more you understand, and that's what changed me and it kept me going. Even today, I do the three things. The music, I write songs and I perform, I played. I also have written the song about the trans murders across the world and I have created a song which I'll share with you. And then, of course, as a person of faith, I still believe in God. I believe in Jesus. And I've written, I keep writing articles about it. I keep speaking about being a trans and a person who is a Christian. And the third thing is nature. My wife and I, we do go for nature walks. And every Saturday, we both go out together and we have our own, we eat breakfast. And I hold space for my wife. I hold space for Celia. Celia is now part of my life. And it's such an amazing thing because my wife had to, she lost her husband, but she gained another human being. That's how I would put it. But I told my wife, sweetheart, I'm always going to be a husband. I know this might not sound right, but it doesn't, I don't care. I will always be your husband. I will always be your wife. I'll always be your partner, your spouse. And I'll always be a dad to our daughter because she has a mom. And I don't want to be another mom. I want to be a dad to our daughter. My daughter said, you know, Dad, I don't want to call you Dad. And I said, you know, sweetheart, you're going to call me Dad. I don't care what the world says. So we have done panels together. Sometimes we change the nomenclature of the world. And these three elements has really helped me to get through life. And even today, it is being such a helpful thing.
You know, there is a sense of healing when we're able to trace our steps backwards and find those moments of joy and those moments of magic that allow us to continue to move forward in the darkest of times and the most traumatic. So you have a bachelor's and master's degree in computer science from Bharathinathan University. So what was your educational journey like as you journeyed through to get your computer science degree?
I wanted to always become a doctor and I was pursuing my career and for some reason, there was a shift in my career because computer science wasn't that popular in India at probably in the 80s or mid-80s, I would say. It wasn't that popular and there were not too many courses around. And there was one college that was offering this course, which is the Bharathinathan University. They were offering this course and I felt like I want to take this course. And I got to be honest here, I don't like chemistry. So for people who are chemists, I'm so sorry not to hurt you. I love chemistry, but I couldn't take it because it was too hard for me to comprehend different things in organic chemistry and all the periodic tables. And I took physics, maths, and computer science. Computer science was my major, and my ancillary was physics and maths. I finished my bachelor's degree in computer science, and I was hoping to see what I can do in my future, whether to do MCA or MBA, and where do I go in my career. And that's when I got an opportunity to do the master's in the same college that I did my bachelor's. And I was privileged to be a part of that program, and I did my master's in computer science. And this was a college which was German-funded college back in India. It was a great education that I had. I had the opportunity. We had lots of computers, so I could learn. And also, the interesting part of it was I was also asked to teach as a professor back in that college. And I was so adventurous, and I said, I don't want to go and teach in the same college. I've almost been here. And so our degree was 3 years and 2 years, master's. Bachelor's was 3 years and master's was 2 years. Once I finished, I said, I want to do something else. I want to work in some area. And so I interned in an atomic power station for 1 year. It was funny. And I don't know if you know these RDBMS systems they had. Ingress was very popular, like Oracle Ingress. And they were SQL and all. There was so much happening.
Yeah, because you were like
so
really at the beginning of
I would say
the boom,
right? And Sybase was there, you know, Sybase, Ingress, and you're talking about Oracle, and of course FoxPro, all the databases were coming in, and I was coding. Of course, I started my coding in Visual Basic and Basic, actually, not even Visual Basic. And then I moved on to Fortran and COBOL. I worked on all this. I worked on Honeywell systems. In fact, the 450 MB was like a big spool. And I had to take this big spool and put it into a big machine. And then I have to pull the tape and then start that system. I worked on Vax VMS systems for people who are probably my age, might understand. Vax VMS systems, Unix systems, and of course, Windows was just starting at the time. Trust me, when I saw the user interface, I was so thrilled. But before Windows, you had other UIs like the Silicon Graphics and big workstations that I did my research on, and I was working on these research projects. So yeah, technology was always a part of my life. And I was such a geek. I was coding a complete operating system. I wrote the Unix operating system on Vax VMS, like literally all the commands like ls-l, or, you know, if you type in pwd, it'll actually give you the similar syntax in Vax VMS. I don't want to go deep into it, but, and that also kept me from all the gender incongruence because I was so thrilled and I put my mind into technology a lot. And in fact, I would say that technology kind of saved my low self-esteem, because sometimes you have this low self-esteem, right? And it really helped back in India. And I'm working with all the research scientists and they're all PhDs and postdocs. I'm just a master's in computer science and I was working in this lab and everyone was awe in what I did because I was good in what I did. And to me, that kept me going. And I worked on one of the first human genome projects that came to India. And I worked in this lab, in crystallography lab, and I'm doing all kinds of marvel wonders in science and looking at DNA and studying DNA and looking at protein synthesis. And I was thinking in my mind, is there an answer in the DNA that tells me that I'm trans? If I'm different, there has to be something about me that's different. I don't know what these answers are. And I was working in the lab as I was looking at it. And that's the time Jurassic Park came. And I was working on the Silicon Graphics workstations that actually were shown in that movie. And we were all like geeks, you know, just excited and thrilled. There was a time when I felt like there should be something about me that is different. And I don't know why people like me are different. And I thought I was the only person on the planet who is trans.
I can't imagine how isolating that must have been. You know, everyone's coming out story is unique, yet there's a deep sense of understanding how the sharing of one's truth can be the most difficult and also the most freeing. Can you talk a bit about meeting your wife and how you navigated the conversation within the context of your marriage?
I was always attracted to women. I was never attracted to men. And that helped me in my marriage. I saw my wife, who is now my wife. I saw this beautiful girl, and my parents had proposed and said, you know, would you like to court this girl? It's a very old-fashioned arranged marriage in India. So I got a chance to talk to her, and we really connected, and I really liked her. And when we were courting, when we were dating, that I was, she asked me a question: do you have anything in your life that I need to know, because I don't know much about you? We're going to start a family together. And she spoke about a few things in her life, which wasn't that significant. And I didn't think that this would be significant because I thought if I marry a woman, she's going to take away my femininity. And that's what a lot of folks understand that. So I felt like it was irrelevant for our conversation and even starting about, I didn't know how she was going to react to it because I myself was confused. I was in denial that I'm not trans and it wasn't the right topic to be bringing up at this time. So I said, you know what? I'm good. I'm okay. We got married and we had an amazing life. And I came to the U.S. I was working for Dun & Bradstreet. They flew me to U.S. and I was consulting with J.P. Morgan Chase. I was doing a lot of work in New York. And 1 year after our marriage, my gender incongruence started coming back. And to me, that was one of the worst moments in my life. I'm here married to a beautiful woman and I'm living in another country and I was successful in my work. But deep inside, I was not myself. I felt like I was some different person. I didn't know what was going on. And I had the urge to go back and wear a clothing. Sometimes when I drive back home, I used to just wear a skirt on top of my trousers so that I could just get over gender dysphoria. It was so bad. And we had our daughter after 3 years of our wedding. And my daughter was a tiny little baby. And I was thinking to myself, what is going to happen? How can I be a dad to her? Is our marriage going to fall apart? And I didn't know the answers for it. And I told my wife 4 years after we got married, when we were in Florida, that's when I told her, sweetheart, I am different. And this is what is happening to me. And she was very honest about the fact that I already, you know, was open about it. And she said, I know of men like you. Why don't you talk to some therapist and, you know, see if we can get over this one. So I called a therapist who was on the phone because I couldn't find anyone close to the place where I lived. It was Jacksonville in Florida. So I called the therapist who was probably down in Miami, and I was talking to this person. And he listened to my story for a while, and he said, you're feminine gay. To me, it was like, what do you mean feminine gay? I'm not gay. I'm not attracted to men. I'm attracted to women. But why would you say I'm a feminine gay? And he said, I know people like you. You're a feminine gay. You will realize it later. And that's your life. So you need to know and you need to navigate your life as a gay person. And I thought to myself, oh my God, what am I talking to? Who is this guy? And why is he telling me what to do? And I'm not going to listen to him. A couple of years down the line, I met a surgeon who does a surgery for trans folks. And this was in Arizona. I was moving in my business to different parts of the country and establishing business for healthcare companies. In fact, I implemented HIPAA for Blue Cross Blue Shield. I did a lot of work in healthcare and I traveled quite a bit. And I had the privilege of being in, you know, the great privilege of living, traveling and staying in the best hotels and all that wonderful thing. And when I was in a hotel, I always made sure that I had my maxi dress with me and then I used to wear so that it helps me with my gender incongruence in the evening. It was such a difficult time for me and I didn't know what to do. And this lady I met, she was a surgeon in Arizona. She was telling me that you look like a woman and you're going to be more happier if you transition. And at that time, it never occurred to me that I could medically transition. And I asked her, I said, I don't want to transition because I love my wife. I love my family. I want to be a dad to my daughter, but I don't want to transition. And she said, you're losing out. I'm actually a surgeon and I've done this across the country. If you change your mind, come back to me. But here I was listening to all these voices and telling me what to do while my heart told me that you need to do what is good for you. That's your journey. And I took control of that voice and I said, this is my life and I'm going to make a decision. I need to know what is going on with me. I started reading all the articles and publications and I started thinking about why are men wanting to be women? And what is it that's really making that shift for this person to think that they are women? The time that I grew up in, it was always about either you're a cross-dresser or you're a transsexual. And those were the two terms that was used. And I never identified in either of them. And here I was trying to do my own research. And I had read so many articles. Actually, these are not like Google articles. I'm talking about scholarly articles. These are actually papers written in Johns Hopkins and Stanford and so many other organizations which are educational institutions. And I found that the answer to my question could be in these ads, in my research. And I found that, oh, this is what is happening to me. People like me have gender incongruence. What is the solution? You learn to navigate through the society. It is like having autism. It's a spectrum and you're in gender incongruence from a scale to 1 to 10. Sometimes some people are in 10, some people are in 5 or 7. I was probably around 7. And I didn't have the need to. I didn't hate my anatomy. I didn't want to medically transition because I have other medical conditions that I'm dealing with right now. And that's the time I found that even within the transgender category, there was something called gender diverse. And I was part of that. And I was identifying with, I mean, I still identify today as gender non-binary because I have socially transitioned. I've not medically transitioned. There's so much to navigate in this space and educating myself that really helped me.
You really bring up a great point that seeking out answers for yourself and gaining that knowledge can really bring a sort of peace in finally understanding yourself. You would eventually move to the U.S. and begin a successful career working in senior management for several Fortune 500 companies. What was the cultural transformation like, and how did you navigate the challenges?
I think in the early 2000s, when the Y2K happened and then slowly it moved on to the dot-com boom, I was in healthcare. I was working in healthcare, and to me, I was managing the fifth largest client for a company called Cognizant. And it's such a big company now, and we have more than 250,000 people across the world. But I was one of those managing the fifth largest healthcare account. And I was really successful in a revenue-wise as well. I was good in what I did. I was a people-oriented person. I had a large team working with me on-site, offshore, and across the globe. And every time I worked with people, I always was passionate towards women because I found that women of color, especially in from India, were not recognized as much as the brown men of Indian origin. So in the tech industry, if you see, it's predominantly Caucasian, Asians, which are probably Indian, and East Asians, you know, Chinese, and those are the kind of folks who are almost in these industries. So to me, I felt like women were not in the forefront. Even if they did a great job, even if they're good coders, even if they were really good in what they did, they were never in the forefront because men were threatened by women's knowledge. Men were threatened by women's power to manage people really well. And so I was in a stage in my life where I did not come out. At the time, I was still Daniel. Though I was struggling and I used to occasionally dress up as a girl and spend my, you know, for my gender incongruence, I was always in the forefront trying to push women of color. I had a client who walked up to me one day and said, hey, this girl is wearing a dress, you know, which is not appropriate for workplace. And I said, that is a dress that they, you know, it's a churidar. Churidar is like a long, I don't know how to describe that, but it's like, it's of course a very decent outfit in India. It's like a salwar kameez where you have a small shawl on top and you're wearing a pant inside and then your dress goes all the way to your knees. And that's the kind of outfit which is common in India. And every woman in India wears that for the office wear. And in here, in this culture, it was not allowed to wear. I didn't understand why because, I didn't know how to tell her who's completely born and raised in India to wear a dress. And I had to call one of my managers and tell her, hey, can you please find us some kind of outfits for her, take her to Macy's and try to help her to get some outfit because I don't know. And I could actually do it because I've done it, but I didn't want to expose myself. So I have empowered women. I, in fact, had sessions specially for women. I have called them and I put them in roles. And even today, some of the managers, after 20 years, they reach out to me and they say that you have really changed my life. You have helped me. You gave me so much of confidence when I was not in the position to do it. So for me, being in that role as a successful businessman, a brown successful businessman, I did face a lot more oppositions. But in the tech industry, it's a very brash industry, egoistic, egocentric industry. So I had to stay on top of everybody to really prove myself. My boss didn't like me because I was people-oriented and I was willing to give chance to people who are struggling in their career. He said, if you don't like them, just replace this person. I don't want to see this person. And I said, it's not your business. Your business is to manage P&L. That's my job. You want revenue, I'm going to give you revenue, I'm going to give you profitability. Don't tell me how to run this account. So I was managing the life sciences for a few companies like Capgemini, IQVIA, and Cognizant, of course, one of the companies. And when I was doing that, I had close to 800 people reporting to me back in India. And and they were all doing BPO work. They had multiple application maintenance kind of work. And then in the on-site, I had people working in Thousand Oaks, close to 120 people. And I hired women. I brought a woman from HR. I flew her from India to manage my account, and which nobody has ever done that before. And I got so much of backlash for that. My boss said, why are you getting a woman here? You know, it's such a hard thing. And now we have to think about her husband. And I told him, again, I want you not to think about these semantics of how I'm running these accounts. I just want you to stay away from people management because you're not good at it. So don't. Don't do it. I'll do it. And that woman, she is now working as a senior manager in Amazon. And she lost her husband. And with the time when she was struggling so much, I was there for her. I gave her references, and she went back to India because she lost her husband to cancer, and she had to raise two daughters. A single mom who was not given hope, and I kept encouraging her. Even when she flew back to India, I kept giving references, so the companies hired her. She did really well. It's not that I did something great, but I was there to support her. She did really well, and she's now a successful, she's working in Amazon. And I wanted to come out to her, but one day I will. None of my team that I worked with know that I'm Celia.
Wow.
Isn't that an irony?
Wow. Wow.
Isn't that an irony?
Wow.
They don't know. They only know Danielle. So one day, maybe I will come out to them. But I just felt I have to take it one day at a time. I've come out to a few of my colleagues whom I worked with in the past. Sometimes it goes well. Sometimes it doesn't go well. But it's a gamble. You know, they're always used to a personality. They put you in a box. And now when you come out, it's very different. So Lisa May, to answer to your point, as a businessman in the tech industry is much more easier to navigate than a person of color who's a brown woman, a trans woman. My salary dropped by 30%. I mean, I want to be transparent here. My base salary was around $250,000, base salary. And you can imagine a lot of that just dropped by coming out. And the last job that I applied for, it was really hard. I was probably making less than $100,000. So
I have to take a beat because I mean, I can't even speak. I'm angry and frustrated that is your experience. You know, as I'm listening you talk about your advocacy, even in your seemingly state of privilege, right, as you were presenting as a cis man, in the role that you dominate in, you are a superstar, you pioneered this space. And then when you finally take that step into owning who you are and step back into the workforce as Celia, your potential for earning and success and elevation in the workplace is completely just gutted. That's profound learnings.
You're right. Sometimes it's really hard. And I did an experiment. So 1 year I was without a job. I was looking for a job. And I put Celia in the resume, she, they pronouns. And I wrote a cover letter as to my transition. So I didn't want to give a wrong impression to the recruiters. So when I applied for a job for a year, no one hired me because they don't want to hire a senior person in a company. So nobody wants to hire a vice president for a trans person in a vice president role. But if you transition within the company from a director to a vice president, they can't do anything about it because that becomes a HR issue. And if they're really good in what they do, that is a different story. But here I was, I quit my job. I wanted to live my life as Celia, go back to the industry and show that I'm capable, but just that I'm different. It never happened. The experiment was very interesting. I changed my resume back to Daniel. And after a year, I changed it to Daniel, took off all the pronouns, took the cover letter off, and I said, I'm blah, 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 I'm such a great person, blah, blah, blah. I wrote all that. I put it out there. You won't believe, Lisa May, I'm not kidding. I got 3 interviews in 1 month. And when I get onto the interview calls, it's basically saying, Daniel, please tell us what you did. And I will just sit and talk, and they will hire me. Trust me, in no interviews I was grilled at all as Daniel, because my credentials spoke for itself. And I did not take any of the jobs because I didn't want to even appear for the interview. I was just testing the waters. And I told my wife, sweetheart, I cannot work as Daniel anymore. Daniel is gone. Now it's Celia. And if I have to face any kind of situation as a woman of color, as a trans woman of color, I'm going to take it. But if I don't do this, I am not doing justice to Celia. And this is not what I want to do. I have probably spent 25 years as Daniel. I can't do it anymore. And my wife said, absolutely. But here's the thing you should do. She told me, start your own company. Don't beg these people. She said that again. Don't beg these people for a job. You are good in what you do. Start your own company. And I did.
Bless your wife. I love her.
You know, I have to tell you, Lisa May, that my, you know, it's not that all about me, but it's about a supportive family. My wife, she's cisgender. And we are still married. We just celebrated our 26th wedding anniversary this year. We're going to celebrate our 27th wedding anniversary. And I'm looking forward to it. And I have a cisgender daughter who's 24. When you have a good support system, it's all about human-to-human interaction. And that is what is missing. Corporate industry doesn't understand that. They look at your color. They look at your gender. They look at how good you are in your English, because it mattered a lot. They never allowed me to speak because they said that your English is not as good as Kevin. Let's have Kevin speak because Kevin is good. Kevin was his white English guy and he will speak. And they wanted an English guy from UK and that guy had an accent and he got the business. And I got the business more than Kevin. But still, they didn't want to put me in the forefront because they said, your accent is not great, Daniel. Now, as Celia, I'm speaking to thousands of people across the world. People are listening. Their lives are changing. The same people who told me that you are not worthy, I saw my worthiness as this woman who is probably a person they would never consider in India, that you're a person of shame. I took the power in the shame. That's the important thing. I took the power of the shame that cast me down, and I made it into something beautiful, not just for me, but for people like me and even women of color. My allies are women and women of color. Most importantly, I would say that I have had some great experience, especially my wife. She now speaks she speaks for me in her office or anytime when they talk about trans people. She's like, hey, you have no idea what you're talking about. My daughter does the same thing today. My brother does the same thing today. My sister-in-law does it. My niece, my nephew. Everyone is supporting me.
Yes.
I cannot ask for more. That supportive system in a family can uplift us. Think about if we have that in our workplace, how can it will uplift the trans person so much.
Yes, I'm grateful that you have such a strong support system because unfortunately, so many do not. And, you know, you owning and bringing Celia to the world, and I'm going to say back to the world, bringing Celia back to the world, putting her at the forefront of advocacy and change, so powerful. And it's led you to eventually start this company that your wife was rooting for you to start. And with that, you bring an intersectional blend of creativity, ethnicity, corporate experience, and even religion in your work, advising on global strategies to implement leadership trust, inclusive hiring practices, allyship programs, DEI metric reporting, pronouns, and self-ID. So what can we learn from your trans evangelism, as you like to call it?
Lisa May, I want to leave our audience with 5 thoughts, and I'm going to make it easy for them. Because I believe that allyship is so important right now. Sometimes we need allies, we need friends like yourself. And for me, I need allies. I need friends. I need colleagues. I need support from the community to really tell my story and also support them as well. It's not all about me. So I will leave the audience, and something that we can all learn is the word allies, A-L-L-I-E-S. A is acknowledge your privilege. You are in a position to help another person. L is to listen to the community. Listen to the community. Every person's story is different. Another L is to learn to unlearn. When you learn to unlearn, it really helps to open your mind to different possibilities and understanding the human being and the humanized standard version of the person. I is to initiate and instigate tough conversations and decisions in your workplace, in your community, in your family, in your home. E is to educate yourself and to educate others. That's the most important thing, which I constantly do. And S is to be supportive by being involved. The most important thing is not just giving money, but also going and standing out there during a Pride event or a Transgender Day of Remembrance or a Transgender Day of Visibility event, which is coming on March 31st, where you go out there and just say that, hey, I want to stand with you because I want to be your ally, and show your support by being there. That makes a world of difference. I think in most of the conversations that I've had recently, I've seen a lot of women conferences where trans women are not invited. And I recently spoke in one, I'm not going to name that conference, but I asked if I can join that conference. I want to join that conference. And they said, they didn't even respond to me because I said, I'm a trans woman, can I join this conference? It's a women's business, women's association. And nobody responded. I tried again and nobody responded. And here they were talking about women of color and women inclusion, but they never included a trans woman. And here I am in healthcare, 25 years of experience, carrying so much of value. And I was just devalued. I don't fit into the men. I don't fit into the women. Where do I go? There is no transgender conference for only transgender people. I mean, for healthcare business professionals, I'm not seeing much, maybe Chamber of Commerce. And that's where I think it's important for us to be open to these women conferences. And I want to tell you, I'm so thankful when you invited me to the Wonder Women Tech Conference and said, you know, Celia, we want to hear your voice. And as a person of color, to me, that made such a big difference. Being in those spaces and interacting with the women and having fun, going in the yard and, you know, sharing space with women empowered me. It motivated me. It made me feel like I belong somewhere. That is what is important today. We need these trans voices. If not me, find a trans person, help them to share the story and listen to their stories. And that's the way we can change the corporate world today. We can change our community. And I'm so thankful that Wonder Woman Tech is really, really moving the needle compared to the other organizations that I've seen today. Oh, I have to give Celia. It to you.
Well, let me just tell you that I look forward to inviting you this year as well. You know, as I mentioned before, your voice is so important. And, you know, as I reflect on my own leadership and my own impact within Wonder Woman Tech, I have to ask myself very hard questions. Lisa May, what don't you know more about, you know, being part of the LGBTQ+ community myself as a bisexual human that has journeyed through all kinds of identity, even with that, because there are voices that, you know, you're supposed to pick one. Oh, now I'm a lesbian. Oh, no, I also have my own coming out journey and story that I've been through. And then now I'm dating men again after a decade of dating women and then realizing this is part of my identity. This is my lived experiences. But then also reconciling the trauma I've had inside of our community and how can I learn more about the different humans that make up that community? Because I feel like there is a healing that needs to take place within the LGBTQ+ community as well. There's so much segmentation. There's so much disrespect. There's so much also forcing of identity on us that also don't fit the mold very comfortably and completely as I am gay man, I am a lesbian, right? So I felt like it was important to learn more from the humans that aren't inside of those boxes, inside of the community that we both occupy, because both of us are in the gray area. Both of us are not seen even within the community that we're supposed to be part of. And I feel like that was important for us to explore. Absolutely. As well.
You rightly said, I think there's so much of segmentation within the LGBTQ community that needs to heal. And only if we get together, we can change the world. I think there is so one of the things that I did in the past 5 years is to learn about the bisexual community and also pansexual community. I have, in fact, we have a PFLAG, we have a person who is bisexual. And I started listening to their story and understanding, you know, what they're going through. Because sometimes we don't listen to each other. And now I have so many friends who are gay. And it's so funny, they call each other she. And they say, Celia, pronouns don't work for us. We call each other she. I'm like, go for it. I love it. So it's so funny. It's so interesting when we try to really work with each other. And I have a lot of gay friends now. And people are surprised. They say, Celia, but these are the people who oppress us. I said, no, you need to be there. You need to tell your story. You need to learn to work with allies because they're our first line of defense. We are like the LGBTQ community. We need to have a unity within ourselves even when we face all these issues. In diversity in clinical trials is one other area that I even work today. And I tell companies that don't show just two couples kissing all the time. That's not the way you show in the media, you know, when you're talking about HIV, AIDS. Or don't show just two gay couple kissing. Show trans folks, show cisgender people and try to mix it up. Don't overdo it. Sometimes the media also overdoes it. So I have been an advocate, I've been in the media industry where I've been telling them what really works. What is the inclusive language they can use? Because we don't want companies to be performative. We want them to be transformative. And that's why we want to humanize it. We don't want to politicize it. We don't want to demonize it. So there are a lot of things that companies need to learn. If you don't know, if you disagree, that's okay. But don't politicize me. I'm not a political figure. I'm a human being. Just humanize me. Don't take away my laws. Even when I want to go to a restaurant, I want to eat and go to the doctor. Don't take away my privilege. And that's why we're having so many anti-trans bills today. That's for another day of conversation. More than 500 LGBTQ, anti-trans LGBTQ, bills we have, and we've been fighting through all those bills, and I've been advocating because it's so important. People don't understand. So yes, you are absolutely right. We need to know and support each other within our own intersectional identities, bisexual women who are Black, bisexual women who are, you know, Asian. So there is a lot of intersectionalities within this. In India, I think the bisexual women are not really taken seriously. So that's one space that I try to speak up and say, you know, how can we leverage that? The learnings from here, how do we, and I've given them a lot of the links to different organizations and also the intersex community. There is a site called interact.org. So to learn more about the intersex community also is very helpful.
Thank you so much, Celia. We're going to take a break for today's Pioneering Women segment. Today's Pioneering Woman is Juliana Tesoro. Juliana Tesoro is notable for having obtained over 125 patents in her lifetime, most of them being in the fiber and textile chemistry field. Born in Venice, Tesoro was denied access to Italy's university system due to the promulgation of the fascist racial laws at the time, causing her to move to the United States. She was then allowed to attend Yale University, from which she graduated from in record time, and received her PhD in organic chemistry at the age of 21. She then worked as a research chemist at Onyx Oil and Chemical Company and was promoted to the head of the organic synthesis department before eventually becoming the director of chemical research at Burlington Industries. Tesoro was the recipient of the Society of Women Engineers Achievement Award. Her most important contribution to the development of flame-resistant fibers. Thank you for your pioneering contributions, Juliana Tesoro. Hello, innovators. We are back with Celia Daniels talking about owning your identity, disrupting corporate spaces, and the importance of trans advocacy and allyship. So you are married with a family, your amazing wife and daughter. What is life like for you today, and what brings you joy?
So thank you for that question, Lisa May. One of the things I've been thinking this morning actually about what gives me joy. Pushing boundaries gives me joy. So interesting, right?
I am here for that.
Pushing boundaries actually gives me joy because I like to be in spaces where no one has gone before. I like to push boundaries where no one has touched before. So there are lots of things. It excites me when I think about when someone says, but that's the way it's done already. And I say, okay, I want to push the boundary here. And that's when my excitement starts. From a family standpoint, I'm so blessed with my wife and my daughter. And that gives me joy as well. Music gives me joy. When I write songs, when I play my guitar, when I sing, it's such a joy and it kind of calms my soul a lot. But out of all, to answer to your point, pushing boundaries is like my super, super joy.
So what's a boundary you've recently pushed?
I can definitely share this. So I was brought in into a corporate company. They wanted to onboard me and they did my interview. I have my own consulting firm. So when they onboard a company, they usually interview and then they put the founder of the company into their profile, the company directory. So when I was brought in during the onboarding, I said, onboard me. I've not legally transitioned. So my name is Celia. Authentic name is Celia. My legal name is still Daniel. So when they brought me in, they didn't say anything. They just said, we cannot hire you or we cannot bring you in because we have a security issue. And they just declined my onboarding. And I was so shocked. And I called my agent. My agent called me and said, Celia, I'm so sorry. We can't onboard you. You know, we have a problem here. And can you reach out to them? Because I cannot. They are not sharing why. So I reached out and no one answered anything. I sent an email and no one answered. So there was a complaint issue. So I went there or lodged a complaint, said, I want to talk to you. They responded to my email and they said, it's not a problem with you, Celia. It's actually a problem with us because we don't know how to hire you. we cannot hire you because your legal name doesn't match your social, I mean, your CELIA doesn't match your social security identity, and it's a compliance issue. We can't bring you in. It's not possible unless we bring you in where you, we are also saying that your name, your male identity name is this, and bracket we'll put CELIA. And I told them, I don't want this job. If you cannot make this change, you have an HRC index of 100%, corporate equality index of 100%. And if you cannot do this just because of this compliance issue, I don't want this job. They called me back after a week. They sent me my laptop and they said, we are so sorry. They apologized. And I was supposed to do training for this company. And I told them, you know what? I'm going to talk about this in my trainings. And they said, please do. And they said, Celia, you have actually changed a 40-year-old conservative company. We have never, ever brought in a gender non-binary person, and you changed it. And to me, that was like, whoa. It is not Celia. It's people like Celia. There are so many folks today. 27% of California identify as gender non-binary. I mean, the youth in California, 27%. In 2019, according to Williams Institute, the numbers have probably gone up now. So if I don't create these pathways, I'm not creating monument for myself. I'm creating pathways for our younger generation. And that's what we want to do.
Yes. Yes. Celia, push those boundaries, girl. Yes. I love it. I love it. So you're passionate about making LGBTQ plus communities, particularly the trans community, feel welcomed and accepted in all facets of society. From the bathroom to the boardroom. So how do you show up for a community as a volunteer and activist?
So I always keep this in mind when I do my advocacy and education. I always believe that you can educate people who are ignorant, but you cannot educate people who are arrogant.
Say that again, because that was just like in that hit in a piece of me that was like, yes, again.
Most of the times when someone doesn't agree with me, when they disagree with me, I give them the grace. I give them the benefit of the doubt, saying, maybe you don't know this. Maybe you don't know what people are going through. So I'm going to tell you again. I try to educate them. And I've seen a lot of people change, even, conservative side, someone who doesn't agree with the LGBTQ community, they at least give them that benefit of the doubt. They at least give them that lending ear. Instead of saying that this is your lifestyle choice. And I tell them, I didn't choose this lifestyle choice. You know, this is my life. This is how I am. And then I explain to them. But the 5% of the people that I've seen, in spite of telling what you're going through, in spite of sharing like 1,000 times about what you're doing, they still think that you should not exist, that you are such an antisocial element to our society. And when they do that, those are the arrogant people. And only 5% of them I've seen in my life. So I always believe that it's our opportunity. We should try and educate people as much as possible and constantly do that, because sometimes people are not intentional. Even this company that I was talking about, they're not intentional. It's just that they don't know how. They don't know how to. They love to hire, right? They love to hire Black community. They love to hire trans folks, but they don't know how to retain them. That's a big problem. They don't have the policies. They don't know. They have not created a change. They have not created an environment. They just go around hiring it. And that's why I tell them that don't hire if you don't have your foundation right. Get your house in order first, and I can help you. And that's why I educate. I also engage with them, because I don't just preach and walk away. I also participate. I educate the clients. And then I also empower the clients to empower us. When you empower the clients, they feel like, oh, we see value in this. We see the business value. We see the human value. And now we want to do it for the community. And it has to be a long term. It should not be a band-aid approach. And that's what I do. And to me, that's what gives me joy in my advocacy. Because I've seen a lot of trans folks, Lisa May, you know, they are so tired. They're like, I don't want to advocate for myself. It's so hard. I'm not doing it. I know everyone is not called to advocate. Everyone is not called to do Wonder Women in tech, right? We do it even in spite of all the nonsense we go through. It's because it is hard. Advocacy, standing up for your rights, standing up for who you are is hard. And that's why when you do it, it gives me joy. It gives me purpose. It makes me feel like I'm doing something not for myself. Celia will be around for a couple of years. I don't know, maybe, you know, how much of years. But what we do, what we open up, what changes we bring in is what is going to happen. It's going to create a change. The younger generation, I don't want them to struggle. When they walk into a company, people know gender non-binary. They go in, they walk in, they are onboarded, they are done. they start contributing. They're being productive, innovative. They start just out contributing. They don't have to deal with all the nuances. Yeah. That's what we do. Yeah. We take care of it.
It's planting those seeds that, as you mentioned earlier, build pathways, and that then becomes legacy. That becomes change. And, you know, you said something earlier that is at the core of who I am as a human and on behalf of Wonder Women Tech and the work that I do and will continue to do. And that's leading with grace, like having the space to hold space for education and awareness, because we make assumption that people should just know who we are, understand how to identify us, how to relate to us, how to support us, how to create safety for us. No human is equipped with that knowledge to be able to do that for anybody else but themselves, right? So we have to have, this is why I don't love cancel culture. I'm just going to say it. This is why I don't love the kind of harmful, you know, narratives that we can inadvertently, I'll say, create when we're advocating for ourselves, because we're so tunnel vision on, I want to advocate for myself. I want a space for myself. Respect me, pay me, you know, support me. But without that grace for people to adopt to new ideas and new understandings and relating to other humans that are not like themselves, maybe you grew up in a podunk, you know, Louisiana. I don't know. Like, you have to have that grace to be able to create change. And I love that you said that, because that is an identifying factor for a true change to happen, is when you have that space to listen and learn from each other.
It can be a fist fight, you know, when someone's yelling at you, keep yelling at them, you're not going to get anything. When someone is yelling at me, just walk away. I'll share one story. It was very interesting. I think it'll be beneficial to the audience. I was in a city hall where they were not allowing, there were a group of conservatives who came in there, and they were not allowing the pride to happen in that city. So we were all standing and telling them why we need this, because there are children. We started all this, and people are yelling and yelling. And here I was, I took a break, I walked outside, and there was a lady who was yelling to her lungs, and she was standing there with her baby. And I came out and I looked at her, and she was so angry. She had a face like this. And I hit you. And I was walking to her, and I smiled and I said, wow, that's a cute one you have there. And you should see her smile. You know, I could see that all her teeth and everything coming out. And she was like, she smiled at me. And that's when we connected. You know, it's like, I may disagree with you there, but you're a human being. You're a mom. I'm a dad. I had a baby too. My daughter, my baby was small, and she's now 24 years old. I see your child, and I connected. That is missing today. That is missing today in both sides, I would say.
Finding that common ground, that common lived experiences, because we actually all have them. For as different as we are, we all have some opportunity to connect on a lived experience.
Exactly. And yeah, of course, we had great conversation. There was another lady who walked up to me and said, so why do you think we need to have this? And I was talking to her, and she said, I'm so surprised to see that you are a Christian. And then I had to talk about it, because they were using, you know, verses from the Bible to disqualify people like us. So I was quoting verses from the Bible to qualify people like
us. Oh, wow.
No, it was funny. But you're right. You know, fist fight cannot get things done. You know, like Jesus said, you know, show the other cheek to these people. It's very difficult, because when someone is humiliating you, standing there and saying that I still love you, or I know you're talking out of ignorance and fear, is difficult. I'm learning too. I'm not saying I'm an expert in that space. I'm learning that, and it's so hard, but I'm trying.
We all are. We all are. Celia, at Wonder Woman Tech, we celebrate vulnerability as a superpower. I would appreciate you sharing something with us that you've never shared with anyone before.
Oh, what would I share? A lot of things I have in my life are mostly vulnerable situations. But I think one thing that sticks out to me is my wife told me after I came out to her, don't share about you to our daughter, because she could take it in the wrong sense. And my daughter was very young at the time. So I said, okay, I will wait for her to get to the right age so we can talk about it. She came downstairs during a Christmas party, and I was wearing a suit. And this is the time before I transitioned. I was wearing a suit. My wife was wearing a sari. And my daughter comes down wearing a beautiful red dress. She looks at me and says, Dad, why are you wearing a sari? I'm like, sweetheart, what do you mean? And she says, I saw a picture of you in the computer. You're wearing a sari. And she was 12 years old. My wife caught hold of my hand and said, tell her it's Halloween. You're not going to tell her that you're trans. My heart broke. I was like, this is my daughter. I can't lie to her. And I told my wife, sweetheart, this is the time we need to tell her. My wife said, okay, it's up to you. I took 2 days, called her in. I have an office. I called her in. Sweetheart, daddy wants to talk to you. Come here. I want to talk to you. She said, what's it, dad? I told her, you saw a picture of me in the computer. I'm going to tell you what it is. I kept her on my lap. She was such a tiny thing, you know, 12 years old. And I said, sweetheart, when I was like you, 11 years old, this is what I faced. I shared all that story about my public humiliation and all that. And you won't believe, it was hard. My daughter was, she just looked at me and said, dad, you know, 25 minutes in, she was like, dad, I get it. What's your pronoun now? What do I call you? And I was thinking, sweetheart, your mom's taken 17 years to accept me and you are, it's not even 25 minutes. Are you good? Do you know what I'm talking about? She said, dad, I get it. No worries. I'm so proud of you. And what do I call you? And you know, my friend Max, he's gay. My friend this one is pansexual. Dad, I know about this community. So can we go? I was like,
I'm over here bawling. What a generational full circle moment, you know, to be able to, well, but it, like in that moment, you know, for you to, I mean, there had to have been like a moment of that 11-year-old self talking to another 11-year-old human that you co-created, that there had to be a level of healing. There had to be this level of wholeness that happens in that moment. What a beautiful redemption.
She's 24 now. Yeah, it was one of the best moments I remember. And I'm so proud of my daughter now. She gets me gifts and we compare our makeup notes. We talk about, we don't just talk about this. We talk about a lot of political things we need to do, campaigns we need to do. My daughter was one of the young Democrats for California. She stood and she won that. So I motivated her to be part of the force where we need to speak up. So for me to see my daughter from 12 years old, where she was completely ignorant to the point where she's now working for Public Utilities Commission for California, being a big advocate for energy and for clean energy and also for trans people and especially LGBTQ and trans community was, it's a big thing for me. I didn't do anything. I'm just blessed. I can say I'm just blessed. I can't say enough. I'm so vulnerable. I'm just bawling when I got to that. It took me to that moment in my office room when I was, and she was sitting there. But it's so funny. Kids are so interesting. They know everything. Yeah, honestly, my wife took 17 years. She took 17 years. It was on and off. Sometimes she will be like, oh, why do you have to do this? You know, people, why do you have to do this? And yeah, it took a while. Now she's absolutely supportive. I can't ask for more. And it's one of those vulnerable moments.
Thank you, Celia. I mean, that was a beautiful, vulnerable share. From breaking conservative barriers in India, to pioneering tech and innovation in the U.S., to bathroom to boardroom advocacy, looking back, would you take the easy road or the road less traveled, and why?
I will always take the road less traveled or the road that has not been traveled, because we need to create these pathways, as I mentioned earlier. We have to explore and find a way to create an opportunity for people to not struggle. And that's why it's important for us to carve those ways, carve those pathways to be there. And even if no one has gone before, we want to do that. I've not seen too many Asian Indian women come up and speak about being trans. A lot of them are in India, but in this country, I've not seen too many. Though I have a lot of friends who have actually transitioned, they don't want to take this road because they say, Celia, I'm good. Advocacy is for you. So this is what I would do. A road less traveled is a road that's really hard, but it's going to make it a little bit better for the person who will be traveling in that same road.
It's beautiful. I just can't even speak. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, Celia, for holding space with me today, for your absolute vulnerability. This is such a pivotal conversation for me. I had no idea what road we would be traveling on together today, but I'm so grateful that we did it together. You inspire me to continue to show up and create an impact in the world. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Lisa May, and for trusting in me and for giving me an opportunity to be part of your amazing organization and part of your inner circle. It means a lot. I mean, I can't ask for more, but thank you so much for giving space, for sharing that space with me. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for being here, innovators. Make sure you give us a like and share the podcast with your network. We'll see you next week when we take on the world one more time.